Hello and welcome to the Weekly Defence Podcast, the show about defence procurement and military technology. We are brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, NAMO. I'm your host, Richard Thomas, Senior Editor Naval here at Shepherd. And this week, as a result of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic, we have moved our recording studio to our homes in order to continue bringing you the latest industry news. And as per encouragement from UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson, Shepherd's staff will be working remotely for the foreseeable future. In the news this week, Japan continues to look for an indigenous next-generation fighter due to enter service by the mid-2030s as a replacement for the aging F-2AB fleet. The Japan Air Self-Defense Force wants this new FX fighter to be easily upgradable over its lifespan without the need for overseas assistance, or impositions emplaced by foreign governments. Heavy participation of Japanese industry is also important, but at the same time, Tokyo wants to keep the aircraft's price feasible. The Japanese MOD has confirmed that it will not pursue a derivative of an existing fighter, thus cementing the pathway for a brand new design with overseas assistance. Over in the naval domain, the US Navy will maintain a two-carrier fleet in the Central Command area of operations for an indeterminate period of time following increased tensions between the US and Iran. An 11 March attack by suspected Iranian-backed militia groups on Camp Taji, a US and coalition base in Iraq, resulted in the deaths of two US and one UK service personnel. Counterstrikes by the US on sites operated by the Tehran-backed Kataib Hezbollah militia drew a subsequent second round of Katyusha rocket attacks on Camp Taji as the cycle of violence continues. Let's hear now from US Marine Corps General Kenneth McKenzie Jr., commander of US CENTCOM, answering questions during a 13 March briefing at the Pentagon about the presence of US carriers in the region.
So the two carriers right now that are in the CENTCOM AOR, the Eisenhower, she just came in, and the Truman. So we're going to keep them for a while, and I'm not going to comment on exactly how long that'll be because we typically try to avoid talking about tactical operations. The beauty of the aircraft carrier is this. It has enormous offensive capability. It has enormous defensive capability. It has mobility. We can move it around. Additionally, there are no access, basing, and overflight issues associated with an aircraft carrier. It's a floating piece of American sovereignty, so I can employ it in a variety of different ways. So we can move it around to present a completely changing potential threat to an adversary. So the carriers are very—they're very important to us, and we know that the Iranians watch them very closely too.
The presence of the two U.S. carrier strike groups centered around Dwight D. Eisenhower and Harry S. Truman is likely intended to act as a deterrent to Iran and its regional proxies. Moving southwest on the map in Latin America, the Brazilian Army has started testing earlier this month on an indigenously developed system to manage the 6x6 Guarani platforms. The Proteus SPG will centralize the Guarani subsystems, providing, apparently, enhanced perception of the vehicle and the environment around the platform. The main purpose of this system is to facilitate the integration of future systems and will reduce its overall costs. And, of course, the defence industry has been badly hit by the COVID-19 virus on an operational level. We are beginning to see consistent evidence that business fortunes are swaying faster than was evident last week. Airbus, for example, has introduced a company-wide four-day pause on production and assembly activities across all of its Spanish and French sites. The company's shares fell 7% as a result of the decision. Elsewhere, other manufacturers have chosen to take less drastic action. Saab's Gripen facility in Linköping is working as normal, the company told Shepherd. However, an 18 March release did state that while its 1st April AGM would continue, restrictions on attendance would be applied. Additionally, the US military Sealift Command Guam Ship Repair Summit has been cancelled, and debate is being raised as to how the UK will be able to complete the integrated review by its apparent July deadline, given the evolving circumstances we find ourselves in. So to discuss this and more, I'm joined by land reporter Flavia Camargo-Sprera and air editor Tim Martin. Thanks both for joining us.
Thanks, Rich.
Thanks, Rich.
So, Tim, what are the latest developments? How much has COVID-19 disrupted the business? And what are its long-term effects, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that there's been kind of widespread disruption. And as you kind of alluded to this week, perhaps more so than weeks gone by, we're really beginning to see seismic changes in this disruption. So, for example, you've mentioned Airbus putting the four-day pause in their facilities in Seville or across Spain and France. And yeah, just one example, I suppose, is the assembly of the C-295 and the A400M happens at San Pablo in Spain. So, you know, recent orders there for Airbus on the C-295 program would relate to the Czech Republic ordering two transport versions and Ireland also ordering two MPA versions, both in December 2019. So yeah, that's just kind of one flavour or a flavour of things on that front. You also mentioned Saab. I was in touch with them. Also, as you mentioned, yeah, the Gripen E facility is, you know, business as usual, but a spokesperson did mention that they would obviously have contingencies or work to mitigate any issues that might arise from further business pressures that as a result of COVID-19 coming to suppliers. But on that front, yeah, there's no kind of issues that they wanted to make the media aware of so far. But I think also there's an issue. We know, of course, that Italy, in terms of how badly that country has been hit, has been proportionally worse than others, second behind China, records kind of have indicated for some time. So Leonardo have come forward and mentioned that they've had a two-day delay or two-day production suspension to the F-35 facility in Cameri. So that's the final acceptance of F-35 there that they're in charge of. And so that's kind of obviously quite a significant, with F-35 being such a huge program internationally, that's obviously put things up in the air for that program in particular. So I think those kind of would be the biggest problems that have been affecting industry. And then when I was speaking to Irish MOD, UK MOD, they're pretty much saying that they're constantly in contact with suppliers to judge any impact. But going forward, they're not aware of delays or anything that's hugely significant. But I think as time develops, I think it's fair to say that these suspensions, pause on productions, look like they're going to not only be reviewed, but they could be extended, given that there doesn't seem to be any immediate signs of COVID-19 abating at present.
Tim, you've actually answered the question I was just going to pose to you, is do you think that these restrictions or these pauses in production and development of various programs will be continued? I can only assume that they probably will be, because you can't envisage this whole crisis being concluded by the end of March, beginning of April, will it?
No, certainly not. And I mean, the biggest indication of that, you could say, is that the government sanctions and government advice right across European states, is to use a no other word probably to describe it, is probably draconian at this stage. And we're seeing more and more, kind of the UK, for example, putting forward 300 billion, I think, for to support businesses, similar in France. And also I spoke to an academic with CIPRI, and she had mentioned that actually one of the biggest considerations here will be to look at how health resources are going to potentially impact military spending. That could be one of the wider issues that play out here. And that's, she said, to very much keep an eye on. Because actually, she had also mentioned that what this pandemic is showing that is that, the underfunding of health across Europe and the resources that are required here aren't really as good as they can be. So yeah, what that means for defence going forward will certainly be of interest.
Absolutely. Thanks, Tim. Flavia, let's talk about Latin and South America. So how much has the coronavirus pandemic impacted that side of the world? And give us an idea as to what measures are being taken by the countries there.
Yeah, despite the fact that Latin America didn't record cases in the same amount Europe has done, some countries are treating the situation as a issue for military personnel, as an issue for using troops and to act with militaries just to be sure the coronavirus won't spread in the country. Venezuela is one of these countries. The country is currently running a military operation to ensure the coronavirus won't affect the population, but troops to close the borders, and also they close the access to the main cities in the country. It includes the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. They are not allowing people move in these main cities just to be sure they won't be in touch with the coronavirus. And only around Caracas, the Venezuelan capital, there are 14 spots of control just to be sure people won't move. In the case of Argentina, the army has created an alert system to identify cases and to support people in the easiest way possible. And they also canceled events and military operations that would involve large amount of people. In Colombia, the General Maritime Directorate, that's the organization responsible to protect the coasts, this organization is not allowing the arrival of cruise ships in the country, and they also are restricting the trips abroad. Brazil, that's the biggest country in South America, is kind of slow now to react, and they are not using military people to act in this situation. We have some information that some military organizations, they put people to work from home, but it's not an official measure. It's just some military organizations, and it's not a national measure, at least by now.
Okay, well, thanks, Flavia. That gives us a really good idea as to what Latin and South American countries are doing. It sounds like they're really utilizing the armed forces to try and restrict access to those countries and prevent, obviously, the spread of this virus. Just briefly on the naval side, UK shipbuilders will be preparing measures, of course, to try and ensure that the range of build and maintenance programs that they have continue. The UK naval industry, when you're talking about companies like Babcock, BA Systems, Camel Laird, and AMP Group, while not exactly being fulsome in their responses to my questions, have spoken of preparations being made, of course, with input from their customer team you mentioned before, like that's the MOD. European shipbuilders have been more open in their response, I think, partly due to the situation being more serious in those countries, such as Italy, of course. Fincantieri and Navantia have both announced pauses in normal works at sites in Italy and Spain, respectively, from the 16th of March, while Naval Group in France has also moved to ensure that key programs such as France's nuclear deterrent are maintained. But it's obviously restricting maintenance and development programs elsewhere at its sites. So these European shipyards are busy building the entire range of naval platforms for domestic and overseas customers. But these programs are obviously going to be affected by the spread of COVID-19 and the subsequent measures imposed to try and stop it. Just to give you an example again of the a timeline that's likely to slip. Well, the second PPA patrol ship for the Italian Navy was due to be launched at the end of March, and that's probably not going to take place now. So these are interesting and trying times for industry, and obviously we're going to keep a close eye as to what they do to minimise and mitigate the delays and difficulties that they face now and into the near future. Coming up next, Tim sat for a chat with the Swedish Defence Minister Peter Hultqvist on the urgent matter of how the spread of COVID-19 will affect the Swedish defence industry, or indeed cause potential complications for future equipment acquisitions of the Gripen E fighter jets and A-26 class submarines. And VP content Tony Skinner grabs a chat with ST Engineering to discuss capabilities and the latest developments of Singapore's primary defence company.
Hey, did you know that Shepherd Media is fully digital?
Yeah, of course. I've already downloaded the app.
I love that I can access high-quality stories anywhere, anytime. That's good for when you're deployed, right?
I actually like that the stories don't waste my time. It's like the editors know what and when I want to read.
And that you don't have to read them. You can watch a video or check out the infographics.
Yeah, it's ace. Did you see that piece on Iran? That piece on the Tor M1 air defense system where they outlined...
Download the free Shepherd News app on the App Store and Google Play, and you can get 3 months half price on Shepherd Premium News for a limited time.
I'm Shepherd Media's our editor, Tim Martin, and I'm delighted to say that I'm joined by the Minister of Defence for Sweden, Peter Holmqvist. And Peter, we're here in London, and if you could maybe just tell us a little bit about Sweden's military recapitalisation of programmes on the Air Force side and on the naval side and on certainly on the land side as well. That would be very interesting because, as we know, there are kind of regional security concerns in Russia, of course, which have taken have become a priority for Sweden currently.
Thank you so much for the possibility to meet. And we have, from the Swedish side, a two-track strategy around defense. We upgrade military capability on the national level at the same time as we are deepening the cooperation with other countries and organizations, because we believe that these two tracks is complementary to each other and is some way to do something that have a real impact and make create stability and peace in our part of Europe. We have between the years 2016 until 2020 invested approximately 3.3 billion euro in defense spendings. We have planned to increase the defense spending with totally 2.5 billion euro between 2021 until 2025. So it's a huge amount of money that we are investing, and we can see that we step by step developing our military capability. Some concrete things that have happened is that we have a reactivated conscription service. We have now 5,000 soldiers in conscription service each year, and the plan is to go up to 8,000. That's one very important topic. We invest in the next generation of Gripen jet fighters. We procured two new submarines from our shipyard Kockums in Karlskrona. We have procured new air defense capabilities from United States, Patriot missile systems. We have invested also in the basical platform for the defense forces. It's in a broad perspective we have invested, and one of the main things we are doing is that we exercise more and more alone and together with others. Exercise is the key to develop military capability.
The increase in spending, was that initiated originally from the Swedish Defence Commission white paper that was out last year that focused on long-term planning from 2021 to 2025?
This started with the defence decision 2015 in May. So that was the starting point for this process. And the white paper from the Defence Commission presented in May last year. It's something that we now will start negotiations around for the next defense bill that I hope we can present to the parliament this autumn and be decided later this year and be valid from the 1st of January 2021.
Okay, and what recommendations would you consider applying in autumn once those decisions are made? Or what are the kind of some of the key issues that would be negotiated?
Yeah, that's a combination of a larger and bigger army and how to invest in a strategical way in the Navy and in the Air Force. We need investments in all these three weapon systems because it's the balance between them that get the best military effect. So the balance between all these, that is the real challenge. But I think we have no material, so we can have a constructive negotiation process around that.
Okay, and would I be correct in thinking from that then that that could be possibly more Gripens that you buy, or are you thinking along those terms, or whether you could accelerate the process for the submarine building, or?
That is questions that I can answer when we have finished this process.
Okay, and if we maybe then focus on the current acquisitions, what are the activities being done on the Gripen at the moment? Because I understand that the Air Force have been testing a number of them. Is that the latest on that program?
Yeah, we have tested Gripen system next generation, yes. And we have a plan also for deliverances of them to the Air Force. And I think that we will have 60 Gripen E version, and then we will also continue with around 15, 20 or something CD versions. So I think that we will have both these versions in the Air Force in the future.
Okay, and when will the Royal Swedish Navy, when will the A26 rather enter service with the Royal Swedish Navy?
It will be delivered before 2025. There is a plan for that in the Spectra 22, 23, 25.
Okay, and what is Sweden's plan with the two Södermanland class submarines in terms of what will be done once they leave service?
I have to come back to that in another fora.
Okay. And is there any plan on that front to sell or to lease them to Poland? That conversation, has that been raised, or is that one possibility?
I have no comments to that.
Okay, thank you. And if we just then maybe move away from the acquisition side then, how significant will the increase in spending be to the military capabilities of Sweden? And can you focus on air, land and sea on in that respect?
Yeah, we will focus on all these levels because they are directly connected to each other. But I think also we need to have a stronger army than we have today, because control of the land is very, very important if you have enemy troops there.
Okay, and can you kind of firm up on the relationship between the UK and Sweden on Tempest and the role that Sweden is playing on the programme currently?
What we have said until now is that we have a study to see what sort of platforms are we going to develop in the future. And that's the position just now. But we see this as a serious project that open up the doors for the generation after the next generation, the generation after 2040. So it's a very long-term project, and it's very important for Swedish industry and for what will come after JAS Gripen 39E version. So I think that we've started something that are very important between UK and Sweden.
Okay, and if we look maybe to the future of that programme, there's possibly, from the industry side, there'll be more investment to come. Can you speak to how significant the industry commitment from Sweden could potentially be? Because in the UK, for example, it's $2 billion at the moment that the government have put into the initial funding of Tempest.
Sweden has, in the industry and in different authorities, very deep knowledge and a deep experience around it, the realities around producing and develop aircraft systems. And that is a very, very important and valued knowledge. So that is something that could be invested in maybe a project here in the future. So that is one thing in it. So it's not only about money. Level of money and amount of money I have to come back to later, because there is no decisions around that just now. But we have signed this memorandum of understanding, and we are very interested in the long-term effect of this cooperation between Sweden and the United Kingdom.
Okay, I suppose as we talk, we can't ignore the severity of the coronavirus at the moment. From the Ministry of Defence's side, have there been any analysis of the impact that the virus itself might have on industry and programmes and things of that nature, and what kind of long-term impact it might have on the future procurements, for example, that Sweden are pushing forward with?
The government have taken a lot of decisions around coronavirus and the effects of that. We have given the health authorities bigger responsibilities and a bigger possibility to act to control the spreading of this virus and also follow it up on an individual basis. We have also said that we will close down gatherings with over 500 people. And the government just now is very active to see how can we stop the spreading of this virus. So I think we do a lot, but the question about how to deal with acquisition processes in the defense sector, we haven't come to that in the situation just now. We are concentrated on other things.
Maybe on from a wider perspective, how difficult might it be to deepen collaboration with European partners, given the difficulties with business travel, for example, and as we saw yesterday also, that Norway have pulled out from a large-scale European exercise?
I think that we now are actively working with to stop spreading of this virus in Sweden. And we will take decisions step by step, and then we will come back with information of what we are exactly doing. This is something that has been going on since the beginning of the year, and we started our process around it in January. And we will see now how it develops. We follow it very closely, and then we take decisions about the necessary steps.
Okay, and if we maybe can just touch on the issue of threats, perhaps to Scandinavia and further afield. Russia, of course, have been are presented by almost all European partners as quite a significant threat, whether that's ISR threats. Can you speak of what Sweden is doing domestically and from a multilateral level to counter those threats?
I do not talk about Russia as a threat. I talk about Russia as a reality and what they have done. So that is our perspective. What we are doing is to upgrading our national military capability, and we are deepening the cooperation with other countries. And this leads to a situation where we create more of stability in the long run in our part of Europe. And I think also it's very important that the countries in European Union have the strength to uphold the sanctions towards Russia because of what's happened in Crimea 2014.
In terms of how you deepen those partnerships, as you've mentioned, what are some of the strategies that will go towards meeting that ambition, perhaps in the next 6 months or in the next year?
We have done a lot around these partnerships. We exercise more together. We share information together. We have in the Nordic cooperation a common crisis consultation mechanism. We plan to develop all of these things step by step. So more of exercises, more of interoperability, more of a practical cooperation. And that is the best way also to prepare our organizations for what will happen in a crisis situation.
Okay, I just wanted to finally ask, just on the air domain side, Saab are involved in a number of European fighter competitions. How are the government supporting that? Because, of course, the government would have a national interest in furthering those ambitions, particularly Finland's HX fighter campaign, for example.
From time to time, we in specific countries declare that the government stand behind the Saab offer, and we support it from the governmental side.
Okay. Well, Minister, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
We wanted to take a short break into the podcast to tell you about Shepherd Studio. Studio is our branded content offering, which gives industry a more creative way to tell their stories. Shepherd Studio works closely with companies and event organisers in the aerospace and defence industry to provide bespoke, co-branded solutions, whether it is supporting a particular campaign, content surrounding a major trade show, or bringing Studio on board to more effectively tell a company's story. Studio has already been adopted by many of the major defence primes, including Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, and Viasat. If you're interested in learning more about Studio projects and how they could benefit your company, please visit us at www.shepherd.studio.
So I'm with ST Engineering. I'm sitting down with Mr. Su, who's the Executive Vice President of the International Defence Business here at ST Engineering. So, Mr. Su, first of all, thanks for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
So just to sort of kick things off, I guess, you know, for those listeners that don't know much perhaps about ST Engineering, you know, what are the capabilities of the company and you know, what's sort of some of the background to I guess, what is Singapore's primary defence company?
Yes. Singapore Technologies Engineering, we are a company that has more than 50 years of history, essentially started since the independence of the country. We are fairly diversified and global defence technology and engineering company with operations across the globe. We have businesses in four main sectors, right? In the land platforms domain, the maritime domain, aerospace, as well as electronics. So in the land systems domain, we essentially design, develop, manufacture, and maintain land combat platforms, as well as commercial platforms. In the aerospace sector, we do a large part of MRO businesses, you know, in the aerospace industry. And for marine, we do shipbuilding as well as maintenance. Whereas for electronics, it's the full gamut of digital solutions in the commercial space, in smart cities, as well as in the defense, for defense applications. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So essentially, that's what ST Engineering is about.
And certainly, you know, we're at the Singapore Air Show here. When you go out on the stands, it's a good reflection of, you know, of your capabilities. There are land, sea, air training platforms out there.
That's right. And you can, you're exactly right. What you see here for the air show, we have taken the solutions from all four sectors and integrated them into teams. And essentially, you have three clusters in this air show. You have the defense cluster, you have the smart city cluster, and you have the aerospace cluster. And it is not so much sector-centric, but it is an integrated kind of solutioning that we put in each of these clusters.
And how does the company support the Singaporean Armed Forces? You know, sort of the defence of Singapore being kind of pretty much part of the culture here. You know, how do you guys kind of slot into that?
Yes. We pride ourselves as being the strategic partner of the Singapore Armed Forces. And there are many meaning to that word, starting from the fact that we develop a very intimate relationship with the Singapore Armed Forces in terms of understanding their requirements, designing the solutions and the capabilities in accordance to those strict requirements. And at the same time, we provide end-to-end solutions. Say, for instance, in the case of the land systems, we do the development, the design, the testing, the production, and thereafter, after sales, the maintenance of these platforms. So all in all, what you do is you provide an end-to-end support for the armed forces, and that is very important as an indigenous capability.
And I guess the Singaporean Armed Forces are quite an exacting customer. And presumably, if you do meet those requirements and you've got a product that solves their problems, that's going to appeal to a lot of countries, allied countries, on the international market as well.
Exactly. I've always referred to the Singapore Armed Forces as what we call a reference customer in these circles. And what it means is that as a reference customer, people look on at the SAF in terms of what they're looking for and what they eventually acquire as a definition of what is best out there in the market. And what it means for us, strategic partner or otherwise, is that it imposes some very exacting demands in terms of the solutions and capabilities that we develop. Because we know that the armed forces would firstly know what they want, to a very high level of requirement, very stringent requirements. They would have looked around the world for all the solutions that's out there. And in order for us to be chosen as the one to provide that solution, it means that we must be competitive and be able to match what is, or even better, what is available out there.
And do you guys have a strategic approach for the international market in terms of establishing domestic subsidiaries or partnering with other primes, you know, to access sort of those parts of those international customers?
Yes. It differs from market to market, country to country. Depending on the state of maturity of the industry in each market, our approach ranges from providing off-the-shelf solutions manufactured in Singapore to doing localization, which means to include the building up of production capabilities as part of a contract, all the way to partnering with established local OEMs. You know, as a prime sub relationship in order to provide all these solutions. So it differs from market to market, mm-hmm. country to country, depending on the requirements that the customer imposes, as well as the maturity of the defence industry in that particular market.
Are there any sort of prime examples of where you have sort of sold internationally? You know, what are some of the sort of flagship products that you know, our listeners may have heard of and sort of perhaps not realise it's come from ST?
10 years ago, we actually sold about 100 of our articulated track all-terrain vehicles to the UK. It was based on the existing Bronco series, but it was renamed as the Warthog by the UK Army. And those vehicles were deployed in Afghanistan for a few years, about 10 years ago. And I think we are extremely proud of the fact that the Warthog was probably the only vehicle that was deployed for operational use in Afghanistan that had no fatalities, even though there were more than 30 vehicles were attacked. I think 17 or so vehicles were totally destroyed. But there wasn't a single fatality from all the IED attacks that were directed at those vehicles. And I think that was a vindication of the choice that the UK MOD made in choosing a vehicle, because protection, survivability was the prime consideration under which that particular vehicle was chosen. And we underwent intensive customization to the exacting requirements imposed by the UK MOD in terms of survivability for that particular vehicle.
Yeah, that's a great example. So in terms of your presence here at the show, you know, you're on the land system side. I think you've got the Hunter vehicle. Yes. Is kind of one that's gathering the crowds. What can you tell us about that product?
The Hunter vehicle is the latest land combat platform that we have designed, developed together with the Singapore authorities and the Singapore Army. It was commissioned just in the middle of last year, and it is in the process of being delivered to the Singapore Army for training and operationalization. We are extremely proud of this particular vehicle because we believe it is the best of class in terms of armored fighting vehicles at this point in time. There are a few key defining features or differentiating features for this particular vehicle. Firstly, it was designed to have a digital open architecture from scratch. So what that means is that we are able to insert the latest digital technologies, be it battlefield management systems, sensors, shooters, to enable this concept called network warfighting, where it is the power, it's a force multiplying effect where the power of the force of these connected hunters is much greater than the sum of all these individual hunters all added together. So it's a very powerful concept, and it's enabled by a very powerful platform. It boasts the ability to fight close hatch. Nobody needs to pop his head out, which was, well, in the present context, in armoured and mechanised infantry fighting, that is typically the case where you have to pop your head out to get that situational awareness around you. Mm-hmm. For this particular vehicle in a Hunter, nobody needs to do that because of the superior surveillance systems that we provide for each particular platform. And what that means is that it provides a very decisive edge in urban warfighting, given the obvious vulnerabilities that any exposed crew member would have in an urban setting when fighting from armoured fighting vehicles. And I'll just add on that because we have designed this vehicle with digital architecture, what it means is that it is future ready, it's future proof. Some of the future technologies that we are working on and that we can see it being implemented in the near future will be along the lines of autonomous systems, the insertion of AI technologies, and the enabling of man-unmanned teaming, where the manned force, the manned vehicles can operate closely together with unmanned systems, whether they be the unmanned ground fighting vehicles or unmanned aerial vehicles, to be able to do that effectively and as well as operationally safe manner.
Is this aimed at any particular requirements at this point in time?
It is something that I think most established armies will be looking at in terms of the next boundary to push towards. There's only so much you can do in giving an armored fighting vehicle added mobility, firepower, and protection. Right? The next bound comes from digitalization. The next bound comes from autonomous capabilities. The 4IR technologies, so to speak.
Yeah. Mr. Su, thank you very much for your time today. That was very interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Tony. Thanks for the time.
This episode of the Weekly Defence Podcast was brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, Nemo. As always, a big thanks to everyone that took the time in being a part of the episode. And for our listeners, make sure you like and subscribe, leave a review on iTunes, and tell a friend or a colleague about the podcast. Until next week, thanks for listening.